From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Every day, doctors write more than 650,000 prescriptions for opioids. These drugs often treat pain effectively, but they can also ruin lives. Drug overdoses are the leading cause of accidental death in the U.S. Johns Hopkins bioethicist Travis Reeder developed a dependence on opioids after an accident. He shares his harrowing experience of withdrawal and his thoughts on how the medical system failed him.
Over the course of 3 months of continuing escalation in prescription, not a single physician, nurse practitioner, not a single person warned me about the risk of biological dependence.
Should doctors prescribe fewer opioids? What about patients who legitimately need them for pain? Whose responsibility is it to help patients taper off dangerous medications? It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Today we're going to talk about the opioid crisis. Every day, doctors write more than 650,000 opioid prescriptions, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In some of those cases, addiction follows. As a result, deaths from prescription opioids have more than quadrupled since 1999. My guest today has a unique vantage point on the problem. Travis Reeder is a bioethicist at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute for Bioethics, and he personally experienced a dependence on opioids. He wrote about it in the January issue of the journal Health Affairs, and he's with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Your story begins with a motorcycle accident. Tell us what happened.
On May 23rd, which was Memorial Day weekend of 2015, I was out for a ride. I was starting on a ride, and about three blocks from my house, a large van blew a stop sign and T-boned my bike, crushing my foot between the bumper of the van and the motorcycle.
How would you summarize the damage that you sustained?
The foot was crushed, which for me meant that the inside of the foot, the bones kind of exploded out. Try not to be too graphic, but the important part there is that it caused a large hole in my foot. And when you have a hole that big, it's very, very hard to close up. And so I was in what's called a limb salvage situation where they thought I may well lose the foot. Turned out that I was very fortunate not to lose it, but I was in and out of the hospital for about a month while I had five surgeries.
And what was the pain dimension of that?
It was a huge part of it. I was in pain, in unimaginable pain, for most of that time, and so it was heavily medicated. Post-surgical pain is also very bad, and so I was in and out continuing to have surgeries. And then the largest of the surgeries was the final one, and they took a large part of my thigh and transplanted it onto the foot to close that wound. So they took nerve, artery, vein, muscle, and skin and fat and transplanted all of that onto my foot.
And what pain medications then were prescribed for you?
I was on several different kinds of opioids, as well as a non-opioid neuropathic pain medication called gabapentin.
When did you suspect that you might be developing a dependency?
I had no idea. I didn't have any suspicion at all. Chalk some of that up to shock, chalk it up to being on a lot of medications and not thinking so clearly. It was about 3 months after the accident when my initial trauma surgeon at a follow-up appointment asked me about my pain and my medication, and then looked kind of shocked and said, wow, you really need to start getting off those medications.
Your dosage had risen. You had upped it with your doctor's approval after surgeries with more pain, and then it just stayed. Your dosage had stayed at that high level.
Well, it had continued to go up. So this is, you know, one of the unfortunate aspects to opioid therapy is that tolerance is totally typical. And so to get the same alleviation effect, you have to increase the dosage. And so for almost the entirety of that 3 months, I was continuing to increase the dosage such that at the end of it, I was on really quite high doses.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Travis Reeder of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute for Bioethics. He recently wrote about his experience with opioid dependency and the lack of support he received from his doctors in withdrawing from it. So your doctor expresses surprise a couple months after your operations, that you're still on this high level of opioids. And what happens at that point?
At that point, I went to my prescribing physician, who was another one of the surgeons, and he seemed relatively unconcerned and gave me what I now know to be a really aggressive taper regimen. And so basically he said, over the course of 4 weeks, we will discontinue use of all of the opioids as well as this additional neuropathic medication, do it all at the same time, and do it over the course of just a month.
I know less about medicine than you said you knew when this happened to you, but that does sound like an aggressive schedule.
My wife and I had the same reaction. She's a research scientist by training. She spends a lot of time with the medical community. It didn't sound right to her, but, you know, it was the doctor's recommendation, and we tend to trust our doctors, and so we tried it. And that started a really nasty spiral into opioid withdrawal.
And I want to ask you about that, but I first want to ask, was your dependence, as you were experiencing it then, was it physical, or was there also a psychological dimension to it?
Almost entirely physical. And so it is a really difficult question. People hear my story and they say, wow, the addiction problem is so great. And that's true. But my story isn't actually so much about addiction. It's about biological dependence. You know, for a lot of people, if you take the kind of doses that I took for the amount of time that I took it, you'll just develop biological dependence. And what that means is that when you withdraw the substance, you will go into withdrawal. So you will have the kind of suffering that I had just because your body has become accustomed to it. And so then you ask, is there a psychological component to it? Well, the psychological component we usually want to discuss with addiction is something like a craving and compulsive behavior. And that was absent, which is why I don't think that I had an addiction. But there are psychological components. When you take away medication, it hurts. The pain that you were medicating is now present, and the suffering from the withdrawal is present. And you want to avoid both of those things. And so the need for the drug is a very real kind of striving. So it's a very hard thing to pull apart. Dependence and addiction are really tricky conversations.
Your description in Health Affairs of the withdrawal is harrowing. Walk us through it.
Okay. So it kind of goes week by week because we dropped a dose once per week. And so the first week I now characterize as uncomfortable. At the time, I thought it was rather horrible, but that's because I didn't know what was coming. And so the first thing that happens in withdrawal, or that at least happened with me, is you get very uncomfortable and very restless. Your muscles twitch, and that prevents you from getting rest and from getting sleep. Your internal thermostat kind of starts going haywire. I would hobble out to my deck to get some sunshine, and this was August, and I would sit in this burning sunshine and have goosebumps. And then I would go inside in the air conditioning, lay down, and wake up drenched in sweat. You get flu-like symptoms as well. And so what it just feels like for the most part is the flu with this weirdness alongside it.
And I just want to clarify, you cut your dose by 1/4 because you were supposed to cut it completely in 4 weeks.
Exactly.
So you're still taking opioids, I guess, daily?
Yes.
But at a lower level.
That's right.
What happened the second week?
The second week, things got significantly worse. I stopped trying to get any real rest, basically. You know, I still had this very damaged foot. I hadn't walked yet. Doctors were saying that I likely wouldn't walk again. And so I was fairly immobile anyway, and the flu symptoms were getting bad enough, and I wasn't eating, and I had lots of intestinal distress. And so I basically stopped moving. I sat on the couch for 24 hours a day, which, as you can imagine, was very distressing to my family. And so at least by then, if not in the first week, we started to call the doctors. And the really shocking thing was that my prescribing doctor said, oh, well, that sounds unfortunate. You know, if it's too hard, you can go back on the medication. And I said,
how did you react to that?
I said, well, okay, and then what? And he said, well, you can go back on the medication to stabilize and then try again later. Well, I'd already been through what felt like a lot of suffering at the time. You know, this had been a really, really unpleasant minute by minute sort of ordeal. I wasn't going to erase that if I didn't have a better plan for the next time. And so I said, well, I think I'm going to stick with it. And he said, well, then, you know, drink lots of fluids and, you know, take lots of stool softeners, you know, try to make yourself feel better. So that was really frustrating. And we began to call other doctors as well.
You're talking about doctors who were part of your treatment team?
Initially, yes, although we eventually called anyone who'd pick up the phone. We called the pain management team at my treating hospital who had set me up on this regimen. And we thought, surely, you know, they're the pain experts. They're the ones who actually have this training. And we were shocked that we couldn't even get in the door with them because the gatekeepers, the people who answer the phone, said our pain management team is inpatient. They deal with prescribing medication and making your pain manageable, they don't deal with tapering or withdrawal symptom management. We felt really hopeless. I was getting very depressed, and this was also biological reaction. Depression is a major symptom of this sort of withdrawal. I had lots of crying spells. And when I was basically told I was going to get no help, I was just devastated.
And let me just clarify on that point. I mean, you'd been through a really bad accident that left a big hole in your foot that took some really painful surgeries. Were you depressed during that period of time?
I had one moment of what I thought of as kind of fear and sadness and depression. I'm a pretty upbeat person. And on day 3 or 4 after the accident was when I was told that I'd probably lose my foot. And when the surgeon told me that, I cried for the first time. And the world kind of spiraled in. And, you know, for all of 30 minutes or something, I felt depressed. And then the physical therapist came in to see me and she said, "I think you'll walk again." And I said, "Me too." And I was fine. And so this was not my state of mind prior to the withdrawal. So week 3 is what I think of as the time when things went off the rails.
In what way?
I was basically crying all the time because I thought my life was over. And like I said, this is minute by minute, right? So all I do is lay on the couch and think about how miserable I am. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. Every muscle in my body ached. I was in incredible pain because I was withdrawing off the medication that had been keeping me out of pain. And your brain feels like it's in a fog. I felt so profoundly broken. And what I would say to my wife is, I can't imagine that the human body can recover from this. And that's what I thought. I thought this was going to be the rest of my life. And of course, if you are this miserable and you think you'll never recover, well, then what are you going to do? This is not a life worth living. This is when things got really, really scary.
So what happened?
So in week 4, we had started calling anyone. And essentially what happened is we were told by general practitioners of any kind, well, we prescribe this medication, but we don't deal with the tapering or the withdrawal process. We were told by pain management teams that we only take care of settling pain. We're not involved on the back end. And when I begged them, when I got really desperate, they clearly were making a judgment about me as the panic entered my voice. And they said, "Well, you sound like you need to go to a methadone clinic." And so I said, "Sure, I'll go if they'll help me." And so I started calling methadone clinics. But as soon as they heard my story, they were like, "Look, you aren't the target population here. We prescribe ultra long-acting methadone maintenance therapy for people who have been addicted to these drugs for years." So nobody was going to help me is what I found out. No one saw me as their problem. And so I fell through the cracks of this complex system where one person just passed me off to the other.
So what did you do?
We tried our absolute hardest to stick it out. And my wife, who is clearly a saint, came home every day whenever I needed her to. And my toddler daughter would give me hugs and kisses and make me think I could get through a few more minutes of this. And it still wasn't enough. And then on about day 6 of week 4, I was finally told by the last clinic we called that they could treat withdrawal symptoms. They could help me do this process. And I was so relieved. And I said, "We can leave right now. When can you see us?" And they said, "Well, we can see you in 5 days. And I just lost it.
Because you didn't think you could make it through 5 days.
I didn't think I could make it through 5 more days. And so when I begged her and she said, "No, if it's an emergency, go to the emergency room," I hung up and I told my wife, "I'm done. I can't fight anymore. We need to go get some more of the pills." And of course, all of the doctors had been telling me that if it was that bad, I could go back on the medication. So I had access to it. The access wasn't the problem. I said, "Call the doctor and see what's the lowest dose I can refill so that at least I can start off lower and hope to not have to go through this all again."
So you got the pills.
So we got the pills. And I actually went to bed that night, first time in weeks. My wife helped me up the stairs and went to bed. I put the pills on the nightstand so that they were within reach, and I asked my wife to set a glass of water beside there because I wasn't going to take anything if I didn't at least try to make it through the night first. And so I said out loud, I said, "In 4 hours, if I'm still awake, I will take one." And I think the last time I looked at the clock, it was 2 hours later, and then I fell asleep. And I woke up something like 6 hours later. I think I slept from like midnight to six, but I hadn't slept more than 15 minutes at a time in weeks. And so I woke up after 6 hours of sleep, and I'm sure that I felt objectively terrible. You know, I still had a lot of residual symptoms, but compared to where I'd been, I felt like I could jump up and start doing jumping jacks. And so I knew I'd made it out.
You essentially had gone cold turkey. You had gotten off the drugs. We need to take a break. This is probably a good time to do it. And when we come back, I want to talk about what lessons we can all draw from this. Travis Reeder is a bioethicist at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute for Bioethics. He wrote about his experience with opioid dependency and withdrawal in the January issue of the journal Health Affairs. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Johns Hopkins Berman Institute bioethicist Travis Reeder. He wrote about his experience with opioid dependency and withdrawal in the January issue of the journal Health Affairs. You write about how angry you were when you came through your addiction. You're angry that your doctors couldn't or wouldn't help you with your withdrawal. What do you think should have happened?
Well, I was angry at first because I thought that my individual doctors had screwed up. And in some sense, this is true. I mean, they should have done better by me. But what I came to understand is that the problem is much bigger than my handful of physicians. And so what certainly should have happened is that somebody along the way should have seen me as their responsibility. And I should have been prescribed correct tapering regimen. So the first thing to know is that you withdraw from one medication at a time. So I was on multiple ones at a rate as low as 10% per week instead of a quarter or 25% per week. But even then, if you've been on high doses like I'd been, you may have symptoms that can be managed with medication, and that requires some training. And so one of the first things that should have happened is there should have been somebody with sufficiently specialized training to take care of me, either among my physicians, or they should have known someone that they could recommend me to.
Well, let me go back even further. Do you think that you were prescribed too much opioid to begin with?
It's a really hard question. It's an important question. What certainly should have happened is I should have been counseled the whole time. So here's an amazing fact that still blows my mind. Over the course of 3 months of continuing escalation in prescription, not a single physician, nurse practitioner, not a single person warned me about the risk of biological dependence, warned me about the fact that I was going to face a difficult withdrawal process at the end of this. Now, you might say, perhaps you should have known that, and fair enough, but I didn't, and nobody talked to me about it. And that's a huge, huge oversight. So there's certainly an education gap that somebody should have been teaching me all along the way and preparing me so that I could have seen, well, perhaps I don't want to up the dose this time. Maybe the risk of a little bit more pain is worth it to forestall the really bad times to come.
You write that after your motorcycle accident and the surgeries, quote, my life revolved around keeping my pain manageable, close quote. If a patient is asking for relief and that relief exists, I can see how it would be difficult for a doctor to withhold it.
That's exactly right. Some scholars who want to talk about the opioid crisis or the opioid epidemic are quick to say we are too loose in our opioid prescribing. Now, that's almost certainly true. There's a lot of looseness that's due to lack of education. But the lesson they draw from that is that we should tighten up prescriptions. We should use them less. People who are in pain maybe shouldn't have as much access to them. That's not obviously the way things should go, right? So traumatic pain is incredibly difficult to manage, and opioids are really, really good at managing it. So after the accident, my first night in the hospital, I hit a 10 on the pain scale for the only time in my life, and it is unimaginable suffering. And when I got fentanyl afterwards, it went away. It was like magic. So to withhold that kind of medication from people who are in, you know, suicidal levels of pain would be cruel. To rail against opioids is to risk undermanaging pain.
Because there is a debate going on in the medical community. Doctors are looking too at the number of overdose deaths from opioids. There are some doctors who say we shouldn't prescribe them. We should not be putting people at risk of dependency. I mean, you're a bioethicist. Do you have some words of advice to the prescribing community?
I do. I think we have to be really, really worried about oversimplifying this issue. So for over a century, we've had a pendulum of opinion about opioids swing back and forth. So at first, opioids were magic pills that cured all that ailed us. And then we saw the threat of addiction, and the pendulum swung really quick and slammed against the other end, and opioids were evil, and we should regulate them and hardly ever give them out. And we've done this swing at least twice more, and what we're facing is having swung really far with the kind of movement to constantly evaluate pain and medicate it as best we can. A lot of people think the result of that was the current opioid crisis, and so now we're trying to slam the pendulum back one more time and shut down the access to opioids. The picture's never that simple. It'd be really nice if this were a black and white issue. It's a really, really hard issue because on the one side, you have legitimate pain patients, people who have blown open their foot or who have cancer pain or have fibromyalgia or have sickle cell anemia, whose pain is unimaginable to someone who's never had those things happen. And opioids are incredible for at least some of them. And on the other side, we have 30,000 people dying a year of opioid poisoning. And that's obviously terrible. So what I hope my experience shows is that there is a middle path here. For legitimate pain patients, there should be opioid use. This is incredibly important therapy. That doesn't mean that we can do it willy-nilly. And so what we need to decide is, how is it that we set up a medical system such that people like me don't fall through the cracks? What we know is that 80% of heroin users start using opioids with legitimate prescriptions. And so what we have is we have people who are dying from prescription opioid overdose and heroin overdose, and a lot of that has the same cause. So we need to figure out how, when people start on this path, we can get them safely off so that they don't become part of the opioid epidemic. When prescription opioids become unavailable because the doctor gets scared and says, you know, you're an addict, I'm cutting you off, or when they get too expensive, they turn to heroin because heroin is cheap and widely available. So this is one of the key things we need to do. We need to make sure that the patients who start off with doctors of good intention, with pain that needs treated, don't at the end of the day end up turning to this medication as something that they cannot avoid.
You had another foot surgery last winter after your dependency crisis. How did you manage the pain then?
I was terrified about it, and so I sought out a specialist for advice, and we did a lot of planning, but a big part of it was to go on a non-opioid therapy that was able to do a little bit. Certainly wasn't going to keep me comfortable after surgical pain. And then I took very small doses of opioids for a short amount of time as possible, and the trade-off was I was in a lot of pain for several weeks, but the payoff was that I didn't withdraw when I went off the medication.
So what would you advise someone who doesn't have the resources that you had that second time?
The biggest thing that I would want them to know is that there is, in fact, expertise on this. And that's what I couldn't know for sure. So my physicians were telling me, if you're that uncomfortable, go back on the medication. But I wasn't going to do that if I didn't have a better way to get off of the medication, right? But what I can tell other people is that there is a more comfortable, safer way to withdraw from opioids. And the sad thing about our system is that it may not be easy for them to find, but those people do exist. If you look around, you will find someone who knows the appropriate tapering schedule and who may be able to even medically manage your symptoms during withdrawal.
A minute ago, you used the phrase to keep someone like me from falling through the cracks. And There are probably some listeners who think if he could fall through the cracks, I have no hope of not falling through the cracks. Because you bring a lot of advantages to it in terms of education and professional contacts.
I think this is a really important question. It's not that I'm by nature somebody who ought to have been able to get out of this, but I did have a lot of privileges. I had an incredibly supportive family. And of course, some people who are going to deal with this are going to be living by themselves, right? And I can tell you that if you're in withdrawal and you're living by yourself, you're going to have a lot of problems because I could not get off the couch. Standing up was a genuine challenge. So I had an incredibly supportive family who ran my life for a month while I tried to beat this thing. Of course, I work at Johns Hopkins, and so presumably I could have picked up the phone and called some of my colleagues. I didn't, and that probably has something to do with the shame and the stigma attached to opioid dependence, but I had access to that, and of course not everybody does. So those sorts of privileges made it far easier for me to make it through this than probably some other folks, and that keeps me awake at night. That there are people for whom it would be even harder. And I can tell you, it was hard enough as it was.
I really appreciate your talking to us.
Thanks for having me on.
Travis Reeder is a bioethicist at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute for Bioethics. He wrote about his experience with opioid withdrawal in the January issue of the journal Health Affairs. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.